darle vigencia y bajar el perfil como interlocutor del EZLN y hacer una interlocución mucho más difusa. Seguramente buscarán, por ejemplo, contactos con la CNC, la Confederación Nacional Campesina, que es una instancia del Partido Revolucionario Institucional del PRI, es el sector obrero, digo, el sector campesino, y seguramente por ahí van a tratar de incidir en los movimientos de los pueblos originarios. Sin embargo, yo creo que se van a enfrentar a una realidad que no tienen muy clara todavía, porque prácticamente el conjunto de los pueblos originarios de México se han dado una forma de organización que es el CNI, el Congreso Nacional Indígena, que también se declaró adherente de la sexta declaración de la Selva Lacandona y que seguramente tendrá que ser el nuevo interlocutor de esta instancia del gobierno, que el día de hoy ya aclaran que no se trata de una instancia que sustituya a la Comisión de Concordia y Pacificación, a la COCOPA, sino que es otro lugar, otro espacio de intervención de esta nueva comisión, de esta nueva instancia. Pero yo considero que para que realmente se cumpla, se pague esta deuda histórica con los pueblos indígenas, el primer paso que tienen que dar es elevar a nivel constitucional los acuerdos de San Andrés a Camchén de los Pobres. Esos acuerdos de San Andrés que fueron violados, que fueron desdeñados por el gobierno de Ernesto Zedillo y luego en el gobierno de Vicente Fox, que fueron presentados como iniciativa de ley, fueron tergiversados de tal manera que lo que ahora aparece en el artículo 2 constitucional en México no es ni siquiera sombra de lo que el contenido que tenía realmente los derechos y cultura indígenas en estos acuerdos de San Andrés. Y no se nos olvide que esta mesa de los derechos y cultura indígenas era la primera de 7 mesas que tenían programadas con el EZLN y que ni siquiera la primera cumplieron. El EZLN está en estos días por darnos a conocer cuáles serán los mecanismos y las instancias de relación de los adherentes de la otra campaña, adherentes de la sexta declaración de la Selva Lacandona, para incorporarnos en la nueva etapa del trabajo que nos propone el EZLN.
Era el licenciado Juan de Dios Hernández Monje, integrante del colectivo de abogados zapatistas. Aquí concluye esta edición del informativo Pacífica. Agradecemos la colaboración de todas las personas que hicieron posible este programa. A nombre de Norma Martínez se despide tu amigo de siempre, Fernando Velázquez. Gracias por acompañarnos.
Este y otros programas del informativo Pacífica pueden ser escuchados o descargados en kpfk.org en los archivos de audio.
And you are tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.3 FM. Coming up next on Free Radio, it's Bathrob Spear's Broadsides. I'm Bathrob Spear, Robert Norris. This is a two-hour show. We talk about stuff from the downtown area, the streets, how folks are being treated down there, how they should be treated, what the consequences are legally and in other ways, economically, spiritually, morally, politically. And there is a call-in number, of course, which you can use if you want to be a part of this discussion, and that is 831-427-3772, 831-427-3772. I said before, I'm Robert Norris. I'll be with you until 8 o'clock, at which point Uncle Dennis will come in with From the Cream to the Dregs, which is a kind of a mixture of music and also updates from Earth First and other environmental information. So stay tuned, and I'll be with you in a moment. Let's get a little Ana DeFranco to roll in the show, and then perhaps you, and certainly me. Thank you.
Look here, I just tattooed a wedding band on what looks like to me my mother's hand. I'm no blushing girl, no innocent dove. It took me a long time to find love, but now I have no doubt, and I never will, that I am meant to be loving you. And it barely blew my mind to be so.
That was Albacore from the album Which Side Are You On, Annie DeFranco. You know, the lyrics are more intelligible because slower and less slurred than usual, so I'm not going to read them as I sometimes do. Well, I don't know, maybe I will anyway. Look here, I just tattooed a wedding band on what looks to me my mother's hand. I'm no blushing girl, no innocent dove. It took me a long time to find love. But now I have no doubt, and I never will, that I am meant to be loving you. And it fairly blew my mind to be so sure when that little needle said I do. My love gives me hope. My love gives me pride. My love gets me past the landmines inside. When I am next to you, I am more me. Inside me is a room to which you hold the key. Look at that honeymoon in the albacore sky. Look with all of you, not just your eye. Look at its dancing light through the whispering trees. Look how I love you and you love me. Look how I love you and you love me. And I'm kind of wondering what that little needle is she's talking about, but I'll leave that up to your imagination. So, again, as mentioned before, you can call in at 427-3772 if you'd like. I'm going to be playing some interviews from the last few weeks, and some of them actually a little older. As you may remember, those of you who are regular listeners, there is this ongoing case in court involving a massive over-prosecution, sort of an attempt to shut down political activism of a direct action sort in Santa Cruz, particularly Occupy-type movement, the old Occupy Santa Cruz movement, which was rolling strong about 13, 14 months ago in Santa Cruz and across the country. The famous 75 River Street Santa Cruz 11 prosecutions, of which there are four left, and they're coming up for re-arraignment or second arraignment on Tuesday. Three of them will be arraigned. I believe that's going to be Brent Adams, Franklin Alcantara, or Angel, as we call him, Cameron Laurendeau will be coming a week or two later in February. And the third guy is a gal, Gabriella Ripley Phipps. They're going to be going into court at 8:15 in the morning on Tuesday, the 22nd of January. And I'm going to be there, and I hope you will be too, to support them. I really was encouraged at the kind of support that the seven of us got a week and a half ago, when Judge Burdick sliced off another four of us and said, you know, you're obviously, another three of us, and said, you're not guilty, leaving four left of the original 11 in this year-long harassment persecution effort by D.A. Bob Lee and his subordinate, Rebecca Young. So come in, definitely join what I hope will be a crowd. This arraignment is simply a procedure whereby the court states, you know, these are the charges against you, how do you plead? And, of course, they plead not guilty. There may be some other activity, and I'll hopefully be announcing that on Sunday. If I'm here, and again, I know I've been a little equivocal about this, or I've said I may not be here, and it's true, I may not. I'm trying to nudge myself to get out of town because it's good for my psychic health to spend some time out of Santa Cruz. But, you know, I also like being here. And I sometimes feel obligated isn't really the word, and encouraged isn't the word either. I feel like there's stuff to put out on the radio that tends to weigh in on staying and doing it. And so I tend to do it, particularly if I can't find a better excuse to get out of town. So I will be trying to bring this up again on Sunday if I get more information about the nature of this upcoming arraignment, if there's anything else other than these pleas, but I do think that it just being there to be supportive of the folks is important. I know it felt good to see a packed courtroom when I was sitting up there behind the attorneys facing the ridiculous legal falderal that we've all had to face again and again and again in court around charges, which may result in up to 4 years in prison if people are convicted. Of course, you know, Rebecca Young, the DA, will say something, oh, we're not going to do that. We just want you to plead to this and plead to that, and yada, yada, yada. But so far, nobody, thank God, but it's really hard to make judgments about this kind of stuff. But since the purpose of these prosecutions is to repress political activity and not to deter crime, it has nothing to do with real crime. They aren't going after people who actually committed vandalism. They're going after people who were in this building as a part of a peaceful political protest, which they have no evidence that they committed any vandalism. If they did, it might be a different story, but they don't. At least everything they've shown in the preliminary hearings indicates that this is all based upon this very tenuous aiding and abetting theory, which says that if you were in the building, if you trespassed in the building, then you are responsible for any vandalism done by anyone else, which, of course, is pretty far-fetched and is also ignores the broader dimensions of what's going on, as, of course, this prosecution has done all along, as the power structure in Santa Cruz and across the country has done all along regarding massive, much more serious crimes by Wells Fargo Bank and other major banks and the government in bailing out these banks and ignoring the principal criminals who run these banks and are continuing running the country into the ground and stealing people's homes. And there is some fight back. The Occupy Oakland recently filed an injunctive relief, I guess it was. I don't know if it was injunctive relief or simply financial relief for the false arrests and a large protest that I was a part of last January up in Oakland when police just arbitrarily decided to start attacking people and shutting down the protest. There was an attempt to create a community center up there in a way similar to what happened in Santa Cruz, apparently. There was a large empty building that's still empty and lots of people outside, cold, houseless. This notion of the sacred value of unused bank or public property that is being misused by remaining vacant is, to me, a real obscenity, far more obscene than anything that happens on a personal level between individuals, although I suppose one can make arguments in different directions there. But anyway, the Occupy activists, the lawyers for the activists, have taken the city to court. And I may be talking about that in a bit. I can pull it up on my computer here. I did have three individuals who are going to be speaking on the air. They came to the Huff Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom meeting yesterday. Two of them talking about the harassment as street artists down on Pacific Avenue by police officers. And you're going to be hearing testimony today and a recorded interview from a man named Marty, who I've had on the air before, indicating the kind of simply false charges that police are casually leveling against whoever they happen to find who don't Sieg Heil their presence, and by which I mean show due respect for the police, regardless of how unrespect-worthy they are behaving under a particular situation. One should respect those who are acting in a fashion that is respect-worthy. If they're not, it's important that you not respect them, because there is an important aspect to our society which involves standing up against tyranny, standing up against abuse, standing up against official misconduct, standing up against bogus nonsense being done under color of law with men and women in uniforms, heavily armed, who march around as though they are the last word in morality and civilization, when in fact they're not at all. They're a part of the community, often at the beck and call of the wealthiest part of that community and the most reactionary part of that community, but they are a part of the community just as the rest of us are. And then they have a function at the present time, and that function until such time as we change it, which, as far as I'm concerned, should be tomorrow. But there's a function. I've had my car stolen. I've had the police reclaim my car. I've commended them for it, and I thank them for doing that. But I don't think that stealing people's rights goes along with the job. And unfortunately, due to the repressive last decade and the shift in the notions of what kind of police power is appropriate, what kind of surveillance is a good thing, how a mistaken notion, a paranoid notion of security that has nothing to do with real security based upon the kind of a combination of political opportunism, the foreign occupations that have resulted in rebellions abroad and terrorism against civilians by groups like Al-Qaeda and others. This is being used as the pretext to militarize the entire country. And, you know, I was listening on the way down here to KSCO. It's one of the few stations I can actually get on my radio. I can't even get free radio anymore on my radio, even when I'm parked next to the station. That's pretty pathetic. For some reason, it just doesn't, my automatic scanner doesn't pick it up. But, you know, KSCO, Charlie, what's his name, who does the show? Sorry, Charlie, I should remember your last name, but I don't. Does an afternoon show, is going on about how evil Obama is for his gun control measures. But there is a general, I think, serious response by people on the left and the right who are concerned about government oppression that, well, some people feel that having a gun with you is a secure thing. I'm not a gun guy myself, but I still support the right of people to own them and to have them. And as long as you have heavily armed police force that will gather at Pacific Avenue at the snap of a fingers for a guy sitting next to a building as a criminal offense, then it's not that it's a good idea for the guy to whip out a gun and shoot at the cops, no. But it's not. It's a good idea for people, for the police to know that if they, you know, if they invade someone's home, if they invade, for the homeless, of course, this is no defense. So, but if they invade someone's home, there may be, they may have to watch the step. They may have to deal with citizens who are willing to defend themselves. And the kind of defense I looked for myself has to do with community solidarity when I can find it, public outrage when I can raise it, public awareness when I can spread it. I suppose some would say legal recourse, though I don't really. I talk a lot about some of the legal cases that I've been involved in, and I'm still involved in, often, usually on the nail side of the hammer nail situation when I'm just defending myself. But on occasion, I've struck back and sued the police department. I actually won on one occasion, and this other long-standing mock Nazi salute case is still going forward in the sense that the attorneys that took the case for 11 years are now trying to overturn a jury verdict, and we'll see where that goes. I'm not optimistic about it. But I understand that I think they're right. I mean, you know, you need to have the ability to express yourself directly and clearly when you see repressive action happening, and for public officials to use the excuse of disruption when no disruption is happening is simply a bad thing. Anyway, there were three people who were going to be in the studio talking about how specifically one of them got a citation for having a display of artwork downtown. First, they were going to give him the cop was going to give him a citation for not having a business license. And he says the reason this happened, he spoke to us yesterday at the Huff meeting, was because he was kind of looking askance at the police as they were harassing a bicyclist going the wrong way on Pacific Avenue, which, of course, is one of the more, I guess, the favorite pastimes of police officers, or let's put it this way, it's a pastime you have seen with increasing frequency, and to me it's really outrageous because it falls heavily on people who can't afford these kinds of tickets and citations, hundreds of dollars for tickets of that kind, and doesn't really deal with even a real safety or traffic problem. Although I know some disagree with me. Some say that it's a serious problem, bicycles going the wrong way. I just don't think so. I think it's more a form of class warfare against poor people. But anyway, this guy was watching. He, by his report, he saw this. And he said the police officer didn't like the way he was looking and came over and told him he was going to have to give him a ticket for having an art display, which, of course, is completely constitutionally protected in Santa Cruz. It's not only protected if you have it up, it's up. It's protected if you have a sign that says donation wanted. It's even protected if you have little price tags on your artwork. Contrary to what hosts and cops will tell you, this, according to my associate Robin, a very fine white-bearded fellow who was selling his artwork downtown and got stopped by police and cited, took his citation over to John Barisone, the city attorney, and said, look, there's a court case in Las Vegas that throws out all this crap. It says artwork is First Amendment protected. If you want to sell it in a public spot, you just can, provided you're not, you know, violating other laws that, you know, might blocking the sidewalk or something. And with the broad sidewalks, what's left of the broad sidewalks in Santa Cruz on Pacific Avenue, that's not happening. And the city attorney said, okay, we agree with you. Of course, the police department makes up its own rules as it goes, or it seems to take sort of insufficient heed of these things. And this guy came to the Huff meeting yesterday. Let's call him Joe. And Joe told us that he was given a ticket for not having a business license to display his artwork, which didn't even have either a price tag or the word donation on it, apparently, if I understand him, if I remember properly what he was saying to me. He was going to be here in the studio today, and I hope I can catch him on the air later, because this is actually a story I heard from his neighbor. You may know him. There's a fellow downtown who has an art display which has the big words, "Art is free." and there's all kinds of very kind of small, personally constructed, I think they're actually reprints, up there, reprints of his own personal work, geometric designs, very colorful. And this artist free fellow told me that how his associate, who we'll call Joe, was mercilessly harassed by this cop, given tickets for no good reason, and wanted to talk to me. And finally, this actually happened in early December. I just learned about it directly from Joe yesterday. Actually, I heard him by phone the day before that, but he came to the Huff meeting, which, by the way, is every Wednesday, in case you have any problems of this kind. And if you're a street performer or a street artist or a person who's getting harassed for sleeping or someone who was watching all this and thinks he wants or you want to do something, please come to the meeting or get in touch by phone. Meeting time is 10 to 12 on Wednesdays at the Sub Rosa Cafe. Phone line is at 423-HUFF, H-U-F-F, 423-4833. So what Joe told us with his two associates with him, two friends, was that the cop then said, oh, I'll do you a favor. And he struck out the business license and said, we'll just give you a ticket for panhandling, which, of course, he wasn't doing either. And the reason I say that is because if you are, even if you're soliciting for donations, it is explicitly under the city's panhandling law, not panhandling, not soliciting illegally, if you are doing so for the purpose of an artistic exhibition or performance. And I haven't quite got the words right, but that's the nature of the exemption in the panhandling ordinance, which is in the municipal code, 9 point something of the municipal code. And that, that's not all. Actually, the cop wrote the wrong code section down as well. He put 10 point something, which has to do with other items entirely. It has nothing to do with the actual, even the panhandling ordinance. So he wanted to know, what can I do? I went to the window, the court window, and they told me it was going to cost me $250 if I wanted to, you know, avoid court and pay the bail, which means dispose of the ticket prior to court. And I said, well, you know, contest it in court, although be prepared that you're going to be dealing with judges who are biased, who are prone to favor police accounts. But sometimes if you actually show the specific code section simply is not applicable at all, you can win. And that actually also happened with this other fellow I ran into today, who told me that he went to court for a smoking ticket. And I will be playing that later, so I'm not going to talk about it now. I'm sorry that I didn't have these three to come into court. Another individual told me he also got a phony panhandling ticket for having his artwork. I believe it was a panhandling ticket. It might have been a move-along ticket. That's part of the merchant-inspired, thou shalt not be in front of my business for more than an hour, even though it's a public space and I shouldn't have diddly-squat to say about it, unless there's some kind of criminal activity happening. But I'll be a criminal myself, and we'll help criminalize the spaces because we want to privatize them, even though they are public spaces. And to me, privatizing community space is a form of criminal behavior. They're stealing public space, I know, for their wonderful ice cream sales and their shoe sales and their hamburger sales, you know, and their sushi sales. Whatever their sales are, it's no call for seizing public space. And you see how this happening, kind of in these encroachments, you see how it happens very gradually. These encroachments start small and then they expand. So, for instance, the encroachments in front of New Leaf Market, which originally was a completely open area, and there were two kiosks, one was Sushi Now and the other was Alibaba's Cafe. This was about a decade and a half ago. The redevelopment agency, under Julie Hendy and others, got together to say, oh, let's get rid of those young people hanging out there. We think they're a real social problem. So we'll fence it in and we'll lease it off to these two businesses, actually three, including New Leaf and the two kiosks. And one of the provisions of the lease was that the area shall be open at night where people can walk through there. You may have noticed if you walk by there are chains up now that say no trespassing. So that, of course, has changed, just as curfews have suddenly appeared all over town. Not suddenly, gradually. It's like, you know, the lobster in the hot water story. You don't throw the lobster into the hot water. You put the lobster into the cold water, and then you gradually heat up the water until the lobster is boiled and doesn't even know it. A cautionary tale for all of us is what's happening in Santa Cruz on a variety of fronts. To street performers as well. So I was suggesting to these three that they reform the Street Performers Guild or get together, because there is a guild which at times appears when these kinds of issues come up. A decade ago, when the city attorney tried to reverse, well, when the police department and the city bureaucracy in collusion with the city attorney ignored the directive of the city council, which, while it was saying we don't allow ball bouncing downtown or hacky sacking downtown or a variety of other things downtown, including, you know, you can know the street performers' voluntary guidelines were thrown out. This was in 2002. We will allow juggling downtown. Well, the police decided they were going to ban that too. And Tom Noddy, who's a famous bubble maniac, might call him, a famous bubble artist who's known worldwide for his weird and wonderful bubbles, smoke bubbles, bubbles inside bubbles, square bubbles, all kinds of entertaining bubbles. He's been doing this for three or four decades now. Decided that he was going to challenge the juggling ordinance, and he did. And of course, the police tried to ignore him because they know he's a famous character and it'll bring untoward publicity to town, such as happened when Mr. Twister, the clown, started feeding meters 10 years before that, and he was ticketed, and I don't know if he was arrested or not, but he certainly was cited for doing it. He may have been arrested, and it caused, you know, national or international scorn of Santa Cruz authorities. And so now I haven't heard of anybody recently getting ticketed for feeding meters. So some people, if they want, can walk right ahead of the meter maid and put a dime in each meter, frustrating the poor meter maid's attempt to wring money out of whoever's parked there. And while you might be an opponent of automobiles and think it's a great idea to screw over the drivers, some of those drivers are poor people, and they need their cars to get where they got to go. But it's a kind of a nasty way for the city to make money and to essentially penalize Good Samaritans. And similarly, Tom Noddy was arrested for juggling finally because he kept insisting on doing it. And he then said, okay, we're going to have a national event. I'm calling all the people who are famous performers, Flying Karamazov Brothers and others, to come to town in July, August, September of 2003. And the minute the city attorney and the city council heard this, they held an emergency, not an emergency session, they had an emergency piece of legislation rushed through that specifically articulated that juggling is legal on Pacific Avenue. Panhandling is heavily restricted. I say there's a panhandling ban because there's so many restrictions. You can't do it after dark. You can't do it within 14 feet of all kinds of different buildings, objects, crosswalks, benches. And according to the actual wording of the law, you can't do it if someone else is in any of those locations that may see your panhandling sign. That aspect of the law hasn't been enforced, but it is on the books. So it's really an attempt to criminalize poor people's clarifying that they're poor and they want money, that they need money, and they ask for money. And it's a grotesque inversion of a moral principle to claim that you're somehow helping people by starving them out with these big red meters that are up and down Pacific Avenue that you see that are called Imagine Real Change. What they're really talking about is imagine getting rid of these bums in front of our businesses that we don't want downtown, driving them away. And the same thing is done with all the raids against the poor who are sleeping outside, who have no legal place to go. In Santa Cruz, there's less than 10% of the homeless community. And the rest have to make their own shelter. And that's criminal under the city's sleeping ban after 11 o'clock at night. So let's get into some of these interviews. Since I can't get the three principals here in the studio tonight, perhaps another time, and having babbled away half an hour of the show, which I hope is not entirely without some information, I'm going to proceed to have, well, give you the opportunity to hear some other voices. And your voices, too, are welcome. Again, the phone number is 427-3772. 427-3772.
You You wrote an article on the Santa Cruz 11 some months back.
We're talking here with John Malkin at the latest benefit. Malkin is a radio broadcaster on Free Radio, and every Wednesday night he does a show. And he's also a writer. He's a musician himself. And he's a former member of the once, well, I don't want to say the once powerful, but the potentially powerful Citizens Police Review Board that was disbanded in 2003 by the city council.
Yeah, I think about a year ago.
And then it was published again in Street Spirit, the news.
Oh, yeah, it was. Yeah, I was happy about that.
And then you, have you written anything further? Had any recent thoughts on the Santa Cruz 11?
Well, I wrote a few updates as things kept changing over the year for the Santa Cruz Good Times. I am just hoping that all the charges are dropped for everyone.
Except
involved.
For me, of course.
Well, I don't have to even say that out loud.
Ah, goes without saying.
No, of course, for you as well. I mean, it's a bizarre situation with bizarre charges. It's also interesting just to notice that the Occupy movement isn't what it was a year ago or 2 years ago, and that maybe...
2 years ago, there was no Occupy movement.
Yeah. I mean, so it's gone from...
Zero to top and now down, but dispersed into other things.
Dispersed into other things,
well,
yeah.
That's the diplomatic way of putting it. It's actually disappeared as a movement in that way.
Yeah. It is unfortunate in some ways because you folks facing these charges now don't have maybe the broad support that they would have 8 months ago or
if
something.
Regular meetings, large mass get together.
Yeah. So I'm hoping the best that things go well, and I want to support people in whatever way I can.
And we will be, of course, hitting you up as much as we can.
Good.
Thank you, John. And we've been talking with...
John Malkin.
Thank you, John. And your show is every...
Wednesday, 7 o'clock.
And what's coming up next?
Wow, I just did some interviews, interesting ones. Godfrey Reggio, who's the film director that made Kiwanis Kotze, this Kotze trilogy, with Philip Glass's music. He has a new film coming out in February called Visitors that is a very unusual film, and it also has Philip Glass's music. I'll be playing an interview with him. And also Ray Manzarek, the keyboardist with the Doors, who I talked to him about punk rock because he produced some punk rock albums years ago. So I'll be playing those.
All very apolitical, I might add.
No.
No?
I'm exploring punk rock as a revolutionary movement.
Which former revolutionary movement has become aged like some of the rest of it? Well aged, like wine.
I have remained immortal and youthful. I don't know about you.
You're looking good. I must say, gray but good.
What do I do about that gray thing?
Nothing. It becomes
all right.
You.
Okay, thank
or
you.
Or it is you.
It is.
As I am me, and you are I, and we are. Well, we won't get
I'm
into
the walrus.
That. You are a
cookie pachu.
Cookie cuckoo pachu.
Cucumber chewing cucumbers.
I think you want to sit down somewhere, don't you?
Yes, I think I would like to.
Thank you, John.
Thanks.
We're talking with Ken Foster. And Ken, you, I think about six.
Actually, my apologies. These interviews from the latest benefit for the Santa Cruz 11 at India Joe's restaurant have been aired before, so we are going to have to daintily move beyond them to something a little more new. My apologies for those who have heard them before. John Malkin is putting together an article, as I understand, for the Good Times that updates folks on the Santa Cruz 11. He wrote a very extensive one last summer. Maybe it was late fall. You can find it. It was reprinted in the Street Spirit newspaper, which you can find online at The Street Spirit. And you can also find it at the Street Spirit the Santa Cruz 11 website, where you can get the latest updates on the upcoming Santa Cruz 11 escapades by the district attorney and the struggles to mobilize the community to put this behind us so we can move on. Even the Santa Cruz Sentinel came out with an article, an editorial, wondering what the DA was thinking, because obviously the judge wasn't buying much of the argument by the DA, Rebecca Young. Why are they bothering to proceed? And, of course, I could tell them it's the police department doesn't want to be embarrassed because it didn't move in to crush the occupation early. or bother to surveil it in a way that would actually determine who was actually engaging in vandalism and who actually was doing trespass. And then if your person is trespassing, they're not really trespassing until you warn them that they're trespassing. So you've got to, you know, it's a legal requirement. Excuse me, sir, you've got to leave. Are you going to leave? And you say no. It's okay. We cite you for trespassing. That wasn't done to any of the defendants, period. Wasn't done. Yet they're pursuing these people as though it were done. And this is a fundamentally malicious prosecution. That's one of the reasons that Rebecca Young has been fined $500 by the judge. She's been fined $500 because she has compounded these phony charges by not giving up the evidence, even though it is repeatedly requested, probably because there is no evidence. But she's required to give over all the videotapes, all the police reports, different estimates of the damage supposedly done, huge amounts of overcharging apparently by Wells Fargo Bank that the taxpayers are expected to bend over for, as Wells Fargo always has a nice reputation for giving it up the you-know-what to the taxpayers and to the people who use their services and then don't, want to and are forced to deal with their robo-signing and their dual-track stuff, which I've talked about a bit on the show before. I wish I was more knowledgeable about it. So the DA was fined for this whole thing, $500. Should have been fined probably from $10,000 to $14,000, because that's much more than that, actually. It should have been fined a much larger amount, but that's the amount that the attorney suffered because the DA promised to provide the evidence and then again and again did not, at court hearing after court hearing, in spite of orders from the judge. You and I disobey an order, we go to jail. The DA disobeys an order, it's just a learning experience for her. I mean, it's really kind of comical how loaded this whole and rigged this whole game is. It will be comical, of course, if you're not undergoing this whole ordeal. But that's what these four individuals who are left are undergoing. Gabriella, Brent, Cameron, and Angel are going to be facing another round of this shit coming up next Tuesday. And that's really tires me to talk about it. But I'll be there, and I should also say that tomorrow, Brent Adams will be going to court on another charge, and essentially it's a charge of trying to engage in a little caretaking for the community. This time it didn't involve access to a potential community center. This time it involved keeping an eye on the police department. And I got to say, Brent Adams is often a real voice of moderation. I mean, he's a man who's spoken about the good intentions of former Mayor Don Lane that I think is wildly unrealistic on Brent's part. But it shows that in many respects, Brent can be very, very much, he's very much concerned with including the entire community in his perspective and in the dialogue, in the attempt to move forward as a community. And so as he related it to me, and as I vaguely remember it, because my memory is not too clear at this point of this particular incident, he was observing a police officer ticketing someone for sitting on the sidewalk next to a building. It wasn't blocking anyone, but it violated the Merchants Uber Alles law passed by the city council way back in 1994 and extended in 2002 and 2009, I believe, which makes it illegal to sit within 14 feet of a building, even if you're not blocking anything. And the police officer really didn't like his observing this. I think he might have been videoing the whole thing, too, because Brent is also, as well as being an activist, he's a video journalist who has created on his Subcomandante website, that's Subcomandante, Subcomandante, as in Commandante, not Commandante. And he's looking for donations if you're looking to be helpful in his projects, his video projects. He's done a great one on Occupy Santa Cruz, a lot of piecing together a lot of video, his own commentary. And though I don't agree with all of it, I think it's really important that somebody do this. He's working on more of that. He was apparently, he might have been videoing this police officer doing what sounds to me like another harassment stop of a poor person sitting next to a building. And the police turned and gave him a ticket, even though Brent advises me he wasn't sitting, because being careful not to sit, because that's illegal in Santa Cruz. You know, there ain't no sitting in the city of Santa Cruz with its redwood trees and its ocean views. It's the home of surfers and sad gurus. But there ain't no sitting in Santa Cruz. I don't be caught sitting in Santa Cruz. That's a song by Mark Levy, No Sitting in Santa Cruz, that was composed in 1994 to support the anti-sitting ban protests of that year against the city council's law that has, of course, become worse since then. Anyway, Brent goes to trial tomorrow at 10 o'clock, and I believe it's either Department 1 or 2. They're right next to each other, so you can find out by checking the calendar, in the main courthouse. It's not in the basement of the county building where such infraction cases are often held, but Brent, I think, has wisely moved the case to these two courtrooms where the judges are, well, they get elected, though it's been pointed out by other activists that they get rubber stamped by the electorate, unfortunately. But the Kim Baskett, who's the commissioner in the basement and who normally hears these infraction cases, unless you disqualify her, which you have a right to do, does not get elected. She is appointed, and she's eternal until, you know, God removes her or she decides to move on or something else happens. So come 10 o'clock tomorrow. I'm going to be there supporting Brent Adams. I encourage you to do the same. And more important, supporting the poor people, ordinary individuals, citizens who are being harassed by police under these absurd laws, sometimes done by the whim of the officer, sometimes done by complaint from a cranky or presumptuous merchant or business person. Sometimes done by one of the overeager hosts, like Denise Miller, who has now gotten a reputation for taking out after Brianna Brewer, a woman who was able to essentially embarrass the police, who dragged her into court because she had service animals with her. And they said, oh, you can't have a service animal off a leash. You can't have a service animal while you're sitting with your artwork or you're doing your musical performance. That's panhandling. They made a number of, again, in this case, charges that were not supported. Even if they were following the local repressive ordinances, they were overruled by the Americans with Disabilities Act, which is something apparently the police department hasn't heard of or prefers to ignore if it can. And when she went out again with her dog, she was again harassed by her report by Denise Miller. And she stood up to Miller and denounced her for doing this and demanded to know why she was doing it. And so Denise Miller went to the police. They huddled, and they came back with a misdemeanor charge against Brianna Brewer. And I've talked about this before, for disturbing the peace. So, tomorrow, 10 o'clock, hope to see you at in Department 1 or 2, and we'll see how that goes. Let's hear some interviews from the street and perhaps some phone calls from you, and so I can listen to more than the echo of my own voice in this dismal, well, it's not that dismal, but it's, yeah, it'd be good to have some other voices. Let's at least listen to a few now.
Warren West.
And Warren, you're a man who's, you've had incidents on buses, you've been accused of trespassing because you were sitting on a bench up near the, SoCal and Seabright.
I've had three church bench trespassings, and this was in a mall trespass. And they dropped the trespassing, and I won a jury case, assault without injury, battery without battery by touching.
So this was the same, around the same bench incident, right?
Yeah, across from the bakery by the SoCal Water Street split.
Right, the other bakery, a bit down south. So, how did you have a public defender? Did you defend yourself?
No, I did. I spoke in my behalf and told the jury what happened, and 7-5 and 3 votes to my favor. So that's scary that there's five people out there.
What do you mean three votes to your favor? Oh.
They voted three times. Each time it was 7-5 in my favor.
Now, did you have a public defender?
Yeah, she was kind of lukewarm. They shouldn't even have prosecuted. They knew that there was no assault. And it's scary that five people out of 12 would think that I did.
And what Warren West earlier described this as, and I may have played his account, another earlier account on the air previously, it has to do with the bench, if you're familiar with it, that's up near the Bagelry on Soquel and Seabright, and that little shopping center area up there. There's a sort of a bench in the parking lot, which he was on. I think they were demanding he leave because they didn't want him there. Because Warren is a kind of he's a bald-headed guy who, not the ritziest clothes. Some might say he looks homeless. He fiercely defends his rights when they're questioned or threatened. And, you know, he's an ordinary guy. Maybe, who knows, he may lose his temper at times. He seems to have a fiery temper, too. He was told he couldn't be there. And eventually what they tried to do is get rid of him by accusing him of a battery charge because they claim he touched somebody who was harassing him by his account and went to jury, and the jury just wouldn't agree that that was the case. It's impressive because, as you said, you had lukewarm. I'm not privy to the case, but if his account is accurate, I have no trouble believing that the public defenders, whom we call public pretenders, provide lukewarm support. They just want to get through the next case. They're not interested in defending the rights of these people. I mean, that's not really part of the that's not on the itinerary. Their job is to get through as many cases as possible and get to the end of the day. And the best thing to do is just to plead out. That's where I think, I'm not sure what the percentage is, a very high percentage of cases plead out. But I've often felt in activist cases, the important thing is to take them to trial. I'm probably learning better in felony cases, which involve grueling amounts of time and can involve large amounts of money and loss of privileges and prison threats. It can be very, very daunting, felony cases. But even with misdemeanor cases, I've lost one misdemeanor jury trial in my life, and that was in San Francisco under a judge they had to import from out of the area in the case of feeding people rice and beans with food, not bombs, in violation of a false injunction, which we were able to overcome not by court action, but by just... When I was in jail, people would feed on the steps of the courthouse where I was in jail, and that eventually persuaded then Mayor Brown, not Jerry Brown, the earlier Brown, to lay off Food Not Bombs. And indeed, the prosecutor didn't want to send me to jail, but the judge insisted on it. And so it's not easy to fight back against jury trials, but if you're at least in the past, it's usually the threat of jail that has got people scared rather than the likelihood of convictions happening. And we see now, of course, with these crazy prosecutions against the Peace Camp, 2010 people, against Linda LeMaster, against the Santa Cruz 11, that there is a nastier, vigilant attitude by the district attorney's office than there seemed to have been a decade or two ago when I was being dragged into court for soup crime, as we called it. We were feeding people free food in Santa Cruz and being arrested for it. We didn't get the right to serve people free food because the Santa Cruz City Council is so liberal. We did it because they realized if they kept arresting us, they would look like complete assholes. And they did when they were doing it under that great liberal mayor, Marty Wormhout. With Mike Rotkin saying nary a word in dissent, for those of you who are old-timers and remember these folks. Anyway, I'm glad that Warren West won his case in the sense he wasn't acquitted, but the jury hung, which means there was no unanimous verdict, and so the case, the DA had to either bring the whole thing up again or just say forget it. Let's hear some more.
So that's status.
Was it assault or was it battery, unlawful touching?
Unlawful touching, battery.
Okay.
There was a funny moment when I was the one that was battered and my foot was scraped, and I thought, I scraped my left foot. The scar's still there. And I was looking, told them, the jury, it was on, and I looked at my left foot and they all stood up and I realized, no, it's my right foot. Oh, I'm sorry. And they all looked all bummed out because it was on my right foot, not my left. And I didn't have any scar because it was just like a minor incident.
So how long did the jury take to come to its decision?
It wasn't very long. It was like part of one day and an hour into the next day.
And how long between the time you were cited or arrested and the time the case went to trial?
Over a year.
And do you have any other charges pending against you now?
No.
Why not? What's wrong?
Yeah, so just like the first time, I haven't had charges pending in like 18 years.
And when did this actually happen, this jury decision?
It happened like a month and a half ago, yeah.
So you've been a free man for a month and a half.
Basically, yeah. It was like pretty traumatic. It was like I had to go to court like 12, 14 times, you know, the standard thing.
And they wanted you to plead?
All the time, yeah. The option was there to plead.
Plead guilty.
And I think at that point, unfortunately, we ran out of tape or out of steam. I'm not sure which. So you are, in case you just tuned in, listening to Free Radio 101.3 FM. I'm Robert Norse, and we'll be going for another hour and 10 minutes. Call-in number here is 427-3772. Have you been experiencing some problems in and around court or been subject to citations that seem to you to be unreasonable or having to obey laws that make no sense in Santa Cruz and that seem targeted at a particular class of people? I would like to hear your experiences. Please call in. Or do you feel that these laws are reasonable and fair and assist in the safety and security of the employees and tourists and residents downtown who need to be protected from the menace of people sitting on Pacific Avenue, which has always been a big safety issue in my book. I'm terrified about going downtown. Let's take a musical break while I clear my throat.
Where hunches come from, a message goes out loud.
the guard and all. I mean, dude could be FDR right now. And his daddy's just shifting his weight. And the disappointment is the knockout blow. Filmed and tortured as slow-mo. Oh, oh, please come where I can see. Don't let the poison get the death of me. To behold, we got vampires down here in Louisiana. We need voodoos, we need talismans, we need wooden stakes and shards of light. We need harbingers riding through the night. We need fountains, we need whale harpoons to overthrow the golden tycoons. 'Cause there's no fish in the water, no birds in the sky, no life in the soil. Never too late to try. 'Cause if we all had to change, we all just would. And we would move closer, and that would be good. And we would buy local, and we would buy less. And we'd realize that wasn't our happiness. No, that wasn't our happiness. No, that wasn't our happiness. No, that wasn't our happiness.
Yeah, that was another one by Anna DeFranco, and that was called If You're Not. And the lyrics, although that went on for a while, are pretty simple. If you're not, 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 if you're not getting happier as you get older, then you're fucking up. If you're not, if you're not, if you're not, if you're not, if you're not aware that what you put out is what you get back, that you make the world through the way you act, you can't harness the awesome power of that fact. And it builds up, it builds up, it builds up, it builds up. Yeah, your luck builds up till it's bigger than you. Then it just carries you through. You better ready yourself, because what you're going to do if you're not, 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 if you're not getting happier as you get older, then you're fucking up. That's from the album, Which Side Are You On?, Annie DeFranco. So, here is some more audio from a demonstration about 2 weeks ago at the, I believe it was at the first sort of pre-hearing hearing of the Santa Cruz 11, when we were seven of us going in to face, well, initially to face the judge in hopes that the judge would, through some miracle, see sanity and drop everything, which he didn't. Instead, he forwarded it to the next Monday. This was on a Friday. And I believe these hearings are from the little protest where we were serving coffee and providing literature and talking to folks as they came into the courthouse. I could be wrong about that, but let's listen in.
Listening to Steve Plage talk about the Interface Satellite Shoulder Program.
Circuit, then I can write some grants for that because we use that as a model, be scalable, and we can get another seven. So you get, you know, there's like 146 churches that we're affiliated with, kind of just in the North County area and Central County, and not even going down to South County, which we haven't done a lot of work in. But if we can get, you know, you get five of those. I mean, then you're talking about something.
Is it true that Temple Bethel puts on a Sunday lunch or brunch at the Homeless Services Center?
I don't think so.
They don't?
No.
Adams yet?
No, Dennis Adams feeds there on Saturdays. He has for a long time. And then it was Ron Scadina from Santa Cruz Revival. He was feeding there on Sundays, but now he's doing like
a mini connect
there once a month, bringing in some service people and doing lunch. But I don't think that they do...
So-called faith types. Yeah, they do, you know, like with the...
Well, we were hoping that Temple Beth El would get on board with one or more of our programs. You know, and they may still.
I thought they did feed it.
Yeah, I don't know about that. It's possible.
So how many people does the program currently serve? How many people could sleep at night through
20,
these churches?
20 in each. So you figure if we get five of those circuits, you would be able to shelter 100 people a night for each night, 7 days a week.
Why did this collapse when it collapsed?
Yeah. I have no idea. It's before my time.
Why did it collapse?
According to accounts, it was because of lack of funding.
We don't have any funding.
And here we are, the fundless restoration of at least
this is all
program.
Volunteer and church-based.
The reason the Interfaith Satellite Shelter Program, which at its maximum, I think, served 80 people, and so these kind of wild claims by Steve Plaich, although they're something I'd like to see, 20 people is what they're at now, it's something which, unless there's been some incredible resurgence of compassion in the churches, which, hey, hopefully it'd be great to see, it's like suggesting that maybe the churches should be responsible for Social Security or something. So churches should be responsible for medical care. I mean, it doesn't, you know, it's, I guess in some societies, maybe in Utah with the Mormons, there's more of that kind of an attitude, but not in Santa Cruz, even though you have a massive number of churches, as Steve Plaich notes, more than 200 churches. A very small number have ever allowed homeless people to sleep in their churches on a regular basis, or even park in their parking lot. Three to a parking lot is allowed as an exception to the sleeping ban criminalization of the homeless, which was passed in 1995. A very small number. So I'm always... I feel like saying, blow it out your ass, Steve, when he comes on with all these optimistic statements. But I must say, he is working very hard with others to expand that number. And there are some people for whom it is a real lifeline. A small number of people, 20 people. I ran into a woman today at the 7-Eleven on the way to the studio with two children who had gotten an abatement notice on her vehicle. And I don't know if it was because she was parked in a church parking lot or near a church parking lot. She wanted to challenge it in an abatement hearing. When she went to the police station, she was informed they didn't know what she was talking about. Although there are, and that's part of the vehicle code. My former housemate, Yon Golder, or John Golder as he's known, a longtime activist for sports fields in Santa Cruz, and also on other issues, had the same situation where he couldn't get this vehicle hearing, which everyone is entitled to before their vehicle gets confiscated and hauled away, but which apparently is rarely granted, or at least I've heard of a number of cases where people have been thwarted in getting it. Officials don't know about it. It's a form of, it sort of sounds like a combination of incompetence and or malfeasance and corruption, and I don't have enough information about this broadly to know, but if you've had this kind of problem, or you have more information about it, please do call into the show, 427-3772, or call the HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom line, 423-HUF, 423-4833. So, again, this was all a riff on kind of my exasperation hearing how wonderful and broadly the ISSP program is expanding, and I will no doubt hear from my allies that this is no way to treat a potential ally, a real ally, Steve Plaich. Again, I try to talk facts and rather than fantasies, and I think while it's good to have 20 people, maybe even 25, I understand another church was added, and we got at least seven churches are doing this, so that each night 20 people get a place to stay. When you consider there's 1,500 to 2,000 people out there, I don't know what to say. I mean, that kind of says it all. I will give a call to Steve and see if he has any updates. He hasn't been coming into HUF meetings lately, probably because of my withering criticisms. But it's important for me to be candid, and I think it's probably important for him to do what he thinks he needs to do, too. He's for years been involved in a lot of charity work and public service work. He's a needle exchange guy. He's a suicide prevention person. He was a strong activist with Occupy Santa Cruz and with the DCEL, the movement to stop DCEL, and provide community pools. And he also often has a sense of what's going on in some parts of the activist community, which I think is helpful for all of us to know. So I'll be getting to him pretty soon. Let's hear a little more of his voice. The other voice you hear is that of Bob LaMonica talking. Bob is often used to call in to the Sunday show. I do a show on Sundays. He would not call my show, but the show before my show, which is Thomas Levitt's show, The Wake Up Call, which hasn't been happening much lately. But Bob has strong feelings about the persecution of the Santa Cruz 11, and I believe I have either played his thoughts before, probably last week, or you may be hearing them again on this show, or you may be hearing them for the first time. Bob is a very strong critic of the ACLU for letting ACLU director Mike Rotkin, who one of the board of directors members, supposedly severely impact the boards and making it disinterested in civil liberties for poor people in Santa Cruz, or from Bob LaMonica's point of view, issues like the DIY parade and Wes Modes getting ticketed for walking in the parade while nobody else gets ticketed because it's an attack on him as a political activist who is a big supporter of the Sub Rosa Cafe, an anarchist library. Anyway, here's some more from chatter in front of the courthouse before the Santa Cruz 11 readiness hearing for a preliminary hearing 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, generated. So if we had more money, we could probably, well, we'd go out to get some money to pay our administrator, Ian McKay, who's doing all the work. We've only got one or two monitors, but that's, you know, but it works because it's got good screening, it's got good monitoring, it's got good, you know, security. And the churches that are doing it are treating it like a real community thing. You know, they bring people in. People, like, for instance, we had a difficult time getting Holy Cross on board, because that's the high church, and they really don't want to do this kind of thing. When they finally came on board, and they're doing their satellite shelter in the basement of the school, it's right next to it, but it's Holy Cross sanctioned, they have neighbors coming in from the community bringing hot meals in every Thursday when they do this, you know, sitting down with the people, you know, while you say, hey, you know, we're talking to them. So they're creating a sense of community.
Up on the bluff.
That's kind of nice. Yeah. So it's very different than, I don't know what the other satellite shelters were like, but this satellite shelter has a meal, it's a community setting, it serves a breakfast in the morning, you know, it helps people kind of get themselves off the streets at least for a night, maybe, you know, point in the right direction in the morning. So now that we got seven, Bob, is what I'm saying. Then I can start writing grants for this, maybe get... Because one of the problems is transportation. It's like that's what restricts the armory from running. It's not because they can't get the armory. It's because when they run out of transportation money, they can't transport people up there. So if the armory ceases operations a week or two early in April, it's not because we don't have the armory. It's because they don't have transportation.
And this, of course, was the reason that the ISSP program failed, is because it's extremely cost-heavy, cost-intensive to have to transport people every night via these buses to different churches instead of having a place they can simply go to. Hence the relative economy of the Paul Lee Loft with its 46 spaces. Again, though, again, very small efforts considering the magnitude of the need. And for me, it's not so much like, why can't we have more crappy shelters and charity efforts? But until there is, you know, a real change in society that acknowledges the need for real, you know, housing for everyone, medical care for everyone, people should be left to be able to do what they need to do in terms of sheltering themselves. And in Santa Cruz, that's a crime under the sleeping and camping ordinances.
It's a lift line thing that's administered through community bridges. But
which has to be bonded or something.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, no question. Yeah. Well, we're kind of mindful of all of these, you know, legal requirements and, you know, legal liability and those kinds of things. But if we can get, you know, like we have now a circuit, so if we can reproduce that, you know, several other times, we can get money for it. Get a van or two, and you're not talking about a lot of money. You know, for $15,000, say, a year, $20,000, say, a year, you could really get it up and running. And then that would certainly be a template that you could use to expand.
That was one of the reasons the program failed, I think, before, or faltered or dissolved, was because the expense of driving people to the churches was, I think, too much for them to deal with. And again, you know, we're talking about a program that will take, dealing with a fraction of homeless people, like maybe a tenth at most. But, you know, it's certainly for that tenth, it's good.
It's all cool. And it's got the community aspect, too, which I think is cool.
Yeah.
Which means that they're interacting and they're not discounting them as being human beings.
And
I think that's a key element.
And that was one of the goals of the program, absolutely.
Yeah.
Of course, that does nothing for the other 90% that's out there under the sleeping ban, and those who are doing this program, of course.
It's a start.
No, it's not. It's been started before 20 years. It showed it didn't go anywhere, even when it had funding. It went somewhere for 100 people, that's all.
Okay. But it's a start. And Steve is saying, what, 7 churches or 7 faith-based places, 20 each, that's 140. He's working on the logistics. I mean, it's something.
It's not 140. It means each church once a week takes 20 people. That's the current status. It doesn't happen every night. It's a rotating program, if I understand it correctly. But I will try to hear from Steve more updates on this, perhaps even later in the show. If you want more information about this, you want to volunteer to help this program, the place to go is the Red Calvary Episcopal Church on Monday nights is one place you can go. Another person to contact is Steve Plaich, who is with the Homeless Legal Assistance Project. His number is 466-6078. In fact, I think I am going to actually try to get a hold of that rascal right now and see if... we can get some word on what's cooking. And we'll give him a ring and see if he's answering his phone. And who knows where this will lead. I haven't heard too much from Steve recently, but perhaps tonight we'll get lucky.
Your call has been forwarded to an automatic voice message system.
Steve Plaich.
Is not available. At the tone, please record your message. When you have finished recording, you may hang up or press 1 for more options.
Hey, Steve Plaich. This is Robert calling in from Free Radio Santa Cruz about 7:15, looking for your wisdom update and information, as, of course, you're being roundly criticized as ever. For free radio tonight, if you can and you feel like it, do give a call. 427-3772 is a call-in number here. The specific question that did come up was whether the Interfaith Satellite Shelter Program, as it now is constituted with, as I understand, at least 7 churches, involves a total of 20 people each night by a rotating situation where there's essentially 20 people are served each night, but at least every night 20 people are served, or whether we're talking about 7 churches each serving 20 people every night for 140 people being served, which sounds to me highly unlikely, but I think that there was some confusion about that. So get back to me. Also, you made a claim when you were talking about this issue that $15,000 or $20,000 a year to pay for the vehicles and gas would fund at least a portion of the program. How much would this fund in terms of the number of people would this assist if you actually could get some of these recalcitrant class-based churches to abandon some of the hoity-toity shit and jump on board? Or, I don't know, hold their noses and come on board or whatever, you know, lift their skirts and come on board. The phone number here again is 427-3772. So we'll see if we can get some word from Steve on that. In the meantime, listen to some more jabber in front of the courthouse.
It's not
really a start. It is a program for a limited number of people, and it will not go beyond that. That's the point.
We'll have to see, but at least I think in the sense...
There's no indication it'll go beyond that.
Being a positive change...
for those 100 people. Actually, for the 20 people that are currently getting the program.
Other than denying, I mean, it's a positive thing.
It's positive. There's no question about it, but it's also important to be accurate as to, you know, that it's been done before, that I put a lot of energy into
it.
Energy into initiating this program 22 years ago, and I see that where it fundamentally led was a program for a very small number of people, that's all, that they could brag about, you know, that they, oh, we have this program, and continue to keep laws that criminalize the great majority. So I'm not there terribly excited about it. Although I do tell people it exists, you know.
I think it's a step.
Stepping stone for certain politicians.
Everything is a political stepping stone.
Yeah,
if people see it that way, and anytime something positive happens, or whatever that is, the issue is very difficult. People are polarized by the so-called, quote, homeless, and any step in a direction where it brings it above board further.
I agree. It's not a bad thing. It's just, it shouldn't be exaggerated, that's all. Red Wilson, you're here at this with a large support the Santa Cruz 11 banner. You're not even charged anymore. Why are you hanging out?
I'm not hanging out, actually.
What are you doing?
I'm here with the banner.
Indeed you are.
We'll hold off on the banner because on the line with us is that very same Steve Plaich. Hi, Steve.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm good. And I left you a couple of questions on the machine. You probably didn't catch that because you often just, to your credit, immediately call back when people call you.
Yes, indeed I do.
And one hears a lot of boisterous self-promotion from you at different times, but that is something that is really very solid and that I want to thank you for doing for the last 2 years that I've known you.
Oh, I appreciate that. What are the questions that do you and your listeners have this evening?
Well, the question I had, you were suggesting in this conversation you had with Bob LaMonica 2 weeks ago in front of the courthouse that $15,000 or $20,000 would be a helpful amount as a sort of a seed template for funding vehicles either or funding the gas for vehicles for the ISSP program, the new ISSP program, which is hopefully better than the old ISP program. And how many people would that serve at that level? $15,000 or $20,000
Well, we think that now that we have, or we're approaching anyway, finalizing a 7-church circuit, so we have about 20 spaces each night for people, 7 nights a week, the $15,000 or $20,000 would fund several of those circuits. So when I was talking to Bob, what I was suggesting is that you have now 7 churches. We would like to have 14, 21, 28. You know, ideally, we'd like to have 6 or 8 or 10 circuits. So you can just do the math on that, but we really need a vehicle or two to transport homeless folks from one shelter to another. You know, as you know, oftentimes, because there's no place to store belongings downtown for homeless folks. One of the problems of having to carry everything you own with you, which is, you know, another discussion maybe for another day, but people are carrying a lot of their belongings, have a difficult time even going to the satellite shelters that are in town. Right now, most of them are arguably walking distance for you or I, but, you know, we're not carrying everything we own on our backs. So the $15,000 to $20,000 would, number one, buy a vehicle and pay the insurance on that vehicle and gas, and really help to defray some of the costs for our monitors and administrators, because we have to have staff there that are screening people when they come into the shelter for the night, that are supervising at night to make sure that everything is calm. We have had absolutely no problems with anybody, and in fact, one of the features that's been surprising and really pleasing to us is that a lot of the homeless folks have actually taken leadership roles in the shelters, helping us with the meal, helping us clean up, kind of helping everything, you know, remain very calm and restful. And so that part of the program has been a surprise to us and a very pleasant one.
So, again, the question was, is this 15 to 20 G's fundamentally for a program at that current level to fund 20 people per night, or are you talking
absolutely
about 40 or 60?
Right now, we're funding it now with bare bones. If we had $20,000, that would fund an expansion of the program. In fact, a significant expansion of the program. You know, perhaps 5, maybe even 10-fold.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So we'd make a, you know, make a dent that, and we're also working on trying to get a year-round walk of true walk-up shelter in Santa Cruz. I mean, you know, you and I know that there are at least 1,000 people unsheltered in Santa Cruz tonight as we speak, and maybe more, maybe 1,500, since the survey, which is being taken, as a matter of fact, next Tuesday, as your viewers might hear, your listeners might be interested. The homeless census survey is once again going out into the levees and the places where the homeless are sleeping and trying to count them. That'll take place next Tuesday morning. But, you know, as you, the point being that there may be between 1,000 and 1,500 unsheltered people in the city of Santa Cruz. That's not the county, the city, every night. So we're trying to make a dent in that. And, you know, a year-round shelter for an extra 100 people would help. Several of these circuits for the satellite shelter program would help. Maybe we could actually shelter an extra 200 or 300 people, and that would be significant.
So a couple of questions here. And this is a secondary one, and it is an issue for another day, as you were saying. Storage lockers, are they still unavailable out at the Homeless Lack of Services Center, as I call
it? Well, and I talked to Coral, who apparently had been at the Huff meeting, and I called the Homeless Services Center and tried to get a hold of the day services manager, and I couldn't really get anybody. It was over the lunch hour, and I asked them to kind of call me back. My understanding is that they're still renovating the hygiene bay. They're putting in a dental hygiene station and some other things in there. So I don't think that there are any storage lockers available. You know, as you know, you and I both know, that there were numbers of storage lockers up there for many years, and now that they've closed that area to do this renovation, I don't think any of those storage lockers are available. That's really all that I know, since they haven't really done me the courtesy of calling me back. Shockingly enough.
Well, don't
but,
you go out
know,
there?
You
go out there pretty regularly, right? You used to have a kind of either a workshop or a meeting time out there yourself, or is that no longer the case?
Now I just go out there as the need arises. I'm out there once or twice a week, but you know, my recollection of being out there is there's the dining hall, and then there's the clothing exchange they have there, and then there's the hygiene bay where people can take showers. But I don't. The open locker space that they used to have there, as you recall, is no longer there.
Yeah, they used to have lockers all along.
I think that's all part.
They used to have
all part of the renovation. And I'm as concerned as you are with you know, homeless folks having a place to store their gear during the day. So if they choose to go out and look for some water or panhandle or whatever it is that they're doing during the day to support themselves to survive, they have to carry their worldly belongings around.
Yeah, they used to have lockers actually all around the periphery of the Homeless Lack of Services Center when there was a larger yard area, and instead of having that road that ran in. But
certainly if we can put in storage space and lockers for bicycles, you know, why can't we have some storage space?
I remember a year and a half ago going to one of their community meetings. I don't know if they still have them, but they used to have a community meeting every month or every 2 months. And I remember Monica Martinez saying that they were still hadn't decided whether they were going to put in office space or storage lockers. This was like a year and a half ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess, you know, it's kind of outrageous. I mean, if somebody was denying you or I or Monica Martinez an opportunity to store her stuff for a year and a half, you'd hear screams of anguish. But you know,
I couldn't agree more. Maybe we're just going to have to approach the problem in a different way. But I'm not entirely certain that there aren't going to be any storage lockers out there. But maybe that's something I can look into when I go out there this week. One thing I did want to mention to you and to your listeners, I did go to the Joint Powers Library Board meeting on Monday.
Me too.
And they were having they were vetting two more citizen board members to replace the two that were there. And the new council member, sitting council member, who do you think that might be?
Cynthia Matthews, of course.
Yes, indeed. How about that?
Yeah.
I was...
sad thing, of course. Cynthia is a very...
I was not very happy about that. I was thinking maybe Micah would be on that board. And I don't understand why they reappointed Cynthia to that board. She had been on the board while she was on the council for her last term. But I thought maybe they would kind of rotate that and maybe put in somebody like Micah or, you know, someone.
Well, I actually spoke with Micah about that, and he somewhat closed-mouthed about the issue, but he did say that Cynthia was more experienced than he, and therefore he yielded to her expertise, as he put
it. That's nonsense. You know,
and
it's
of course,
not a question of experience. It's a question of sensitivity of consideration for the patrons, and that's the one thing, unfortunately, that St. Francis does not bring to that position. So,
when, yeah, how much of the meeting?
It's a disappointment.
Yeah, it is for me too. Well, I didn't really expect. The more I look at Posner, the less prone I am to be concerned about any expectations. But mm-hmm. You were at this meeting. I was at the beginning of the meeting. I spoke at the oral communications period of the joint library meeting after their, mm-hmm. of course, absurd expansion of penalties against library patrons who have unruly smells or unattended property, no lockers at the homeless lack of services center, but try to bring your backpack in and get a lot of shit. Although I don't know how much this is actually being implemented. Library staff may be very compassionate. I'm not entirely clear about the reports on the ground. Do you have any sense of that?
I don't. It seems to me that Teresa Landers is probably somebody who would be sensitive to that, but I haven't really heard. I'm at the library every day, so what I see are people there. They're using the computers. They seem to have their belongings. They don't seem to be having their belongings fussed with. There are some people kind of dozing over their books. I don't see the big fellow who is always around there as the security guard. Although he does maintain a presence there, he doesn't really seem to be, pointing his nightstick at people and waking them up and driving them out. So I don't see any of that happening. At least it's not apparent to me.
What about the library board meeting? I actually spent a brief moment of time talking to the board during the oral communications period, telling them, glad that you have passed this, at least, eliminated the sleeping ban as a sort of an ironclad rule. But I was wondering what if anything happened during the rest of the meeting that you think might be of interest to the community?
Nothing. They talked about the budget. They talked about what the new program is going to be, a food for fines program. As people who generate these large fines, they can pay them off by bringing canned goods to their library, and I guess those are going to be distributed to the community. So they talked about that. They did hear from the two prospective citizen board members. There were two openings and only two applicants, so presumably those people will be on the board. And then they elected Lee Pottinger is going off the board, as you know. She was the chair, and I think they elected David Terrazas to be chair. So there you go. And so and then that was really it. They just kind of sat around and talked about those things. But nothing of substance really came up. They didn't talk about any rules or regulations or, any expansion or contraction of the library system or, anything that people would really be interested in.
You also mentioned this Tuesday survey coming on Tuesday morning of homelessness. Is this an opportunity for people who may be homeless or listening to get a job working as a part of the survey?
Absolutely, yeah. What they do is they go out in at least twos and maybe threes, and they always try to pair a volunteer with an actual homeless person. One thing is, they are able to, direct them to places where people might be sleeping because they want to try without disturbing people. It's not as they might, your people are going to be disturbed at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning when they're making this point in time count. But it's important to get as accurate a count as possible. And so for that one day, I guess we can excuse the disruption of somebody's sleep so we can get some kind of an accurate, at least roughly accurate figure of how many unsheltered folks there are in Santa Cruz. So you don't have people saying, well, we have, 300 unsheltered people in Santa Cruz, and why are we giving them all these services when, in fact, we have 1,500 and we're not giving them nearly the services they need. So, yeah, that's there's always one homeless person that goes out with, ideally anyway, with the one volunteer or two volunteers. And I think they start at like 4:30 in the morning or something.
How can people get involved, and where should they contact?
They can contact Applied Survey Resources. I think that's the overall company that does the surveys themselves.
Give me the name again. What's the name again, Steve? Sorry.
Hold on 1 minute. I'm going to put it up on my computer to make sure that I have. I'll do it. Hold on here. There it is. They can try to contact. It's the same people who do the assessment project, the community assessment project. Darn it. I wish I had. I know the people who are doing it, and it's in fact. But
you know, I mean, Steve, I may be doing a show on Sunday. I usually do. I may not. There's a possibility maybe away this Sunday. But if you get more information about how individuals, maybe, I mean, is there a certain lag time? Do you have to have signed up in advance? Can you show up on the day before? How do you get involved with this if you want to earn a little moolah boolah?
Well, I think the surest way is to call them up and see if they still have opportunities available. I think what they like to do is have an orientation. And I think the orientation is, I think you may have sent out the notice from the Monterey folks who are doing their own census and survey, and they were talking about having orientations in advance of the actual count. And so that may, in fact, be the case here, but this is Thursday. You know, they're always, I think, looking for people to help because I don't think they ever really have as many people as they need.
Are we talking volunteers or paid work?
What's that?
Volunteers or paid work?
Well, I know everybody's paid.
Okay.
And I know that for sure that the homeless folks are paid for their assistance.
Do you have a number, a telephone number people can call if they have access to a phone?
Well, and that's what I was trying to look at my computer.
And the name of the group is
getting...
the Applied Research. What's the rest of it?
You know what? If your listeners have one more second, I'm going to check a different way because I know the fellow who's their vice president, and all I have to do is it's Applied Survey Research, and that's the name of the company. And I'm trying to see if they have a way to contact them here. Let's see.
I do have under a Google.
Hold on. Here we go.
There is a number in Watsonville.
Yeah, Applied Research. They're on Brennan Street in Watsonville.
Yeah, that's what I got. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
And the cell phone number is 728-1356.
That's what I got, too. Of course, it's probably not no one's home this time of night, probably, and that's...
They should call tomorrow and find out, because the survey isn't until Tuesday, so there are a couple of more days.
ASR
is the name of the firm, and they do pay the homeless folks to do that.
728-1356, 728-1356 is the number to call for the Applied Survey Research if you want to see if you can be a part of a, of course, now, we hope that the police aren't trailing around after these teams arresting people or harassing them.
I don't think so, frankly. I've never heard of that happening, and these have been going on for some 10 years, I think. First one I was ever aware of was in 2009, but I know that they go back at least to 2005. They have them every 2 years, odd years, 2009, 2011, 2013. So that's where we are now.
Sounds good. You've also been involved in a number of other projects. Of course, Needle Exchange is one where you've been quite critical of Needle Exchange's failure to stand up to recent demands that essentially, in essence, Needle Exchange be restricted or more severely monitored or surveilled because of the many
needles. There are problems that are arising because I don't think that the Needle Exchange leadership has taken strong enough stands. And now, for better or for worse, we have Take Back Santa Cruz actually has a Needle Solutions team. You can go on, and if you're a member of their their Facebook page, you can go on and take a look at that. So people, I think, are involving themselves in public health issues where they really have no experience, and I think that's dangerous, number one, and unhelpful, number two. And I do wish that the new exchange leadership here in Santa Cruz, of which I am a part, but currently are not really consulting them on this, would take a stronger stand, but we'll see. I have to go because I have other matters, but always good to talk to your listeners.
Yeah, I'm sorry. When we talk to you again, tell us why. I'm not quite sure why you don't feel you can't be a voice, you know, yourself about this, and very specifically, if Needle Exchange leadership fails to step up, you've got some information, you know. Think about that.
Well, and I am doing some things, but I'll tell you that another time.
Sounds good, and of course, if people want to reach you, it's 466-6078.
All the time, every time.
Thank you, Steve.
Take care.
Bye-bye. And that was, of course, Steve Plaich, former city council candidate, two-time candidate, talking about a number of issues. Let's get back now to Santa Cruz 11 hearing supporters, actually, talking about issues in front of the courthouse before the hearing.
I think you brought a whole bunch of banners.
And I put it up.
And you actually did. And it
seems to be lashed to, we won't get into the details here. But it's very nice. It's a nice banner. I didn't make it. It was made by other people. I think other people in the community, maybe people involved with, I think, the Brown Berets, the support demonstration here on the steps and the march through town, I think this last summer.
Yeah, that was true. Yeah. And I think that, how much do you think the public support had to do with the case in your church?
This is Grant Wilson, whom I'm talking to. He is a former member, actually a current member of the Santa Cruz 11, one against whom charges were dismissed. The way it worked, charges were dismissed against the two journalists, Alex DeRosi and Bradley Stewart. Then later, charges were dismissed against four people, including Grant Wilson and three others. And now charges were dismissed against three more. And then they were refiled against two others. It's kind of a merry-go-round cavalcade back and forth. For no apparent reason, since, as I've talked before about this issue, it's... I'm not even going to go there. But let's hear more about what Grant has to say. He's a longtime activist in the community, involved with a number of projects involving, the Trash Orchestra is one of his big projects. He's been involved with Art and Revolution, and... DIY last night, first night parade.
Which is being dropped.
My stepdad is
well, it certainly didn't hurt. And one thing I would say is that I also really felt from the start of all of this that I so much appreciated being in community, that I lived in a place where people actually knew me. I wasn't just, it wasn't a town I was just passing through, and I wasn't just, I imagine what would it be like to be going through some part of the United States and be charged with false charges, serious charges, and I would be stuck in that town with nobody that knew me, nobody that could vouch for me, and I really very much appreciate being in community in Santa Cruz. So the support of community, I think, was significant, certainly for me, just for my ability to sleep at night. Being innocent, you know, is a good thing, but I can look in the paper any day and see, oh, that's good. That was an innocent person that spent 12 years in prison, so it still is
chilling.
Sobering.
Yeah.
Sorry?
Chilling, I was saying.
Yes, chilling. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I've been asked what my predictions are for the Monday hearing, and I'm always a pessimist about these issues, but what's your thoughts about what's likely to happen? Monday is when the preliminary hearing actually begins for the remaining seven of the 11 who are still charged. Two of them already have had charges completely dropped, but the DA, or the assistant DA, Rebecca Young, has refiled them, apparently trying to bring in other police officers to testify. I get the impression she's sort of practicing her DA skills. I didn't get it right the first time. I'll try again. You know, we should be charging her as sort of a training course for her activity. But what's your prediction about that?
Well, I really don't know. This is my first significant experience with the court system, and I would say it is pretty unfathomable to really understand the minutiae or the back kind of the subtle dealings and the protocol and the legal maneuvers that can happen. And I think that it's really hard to say. I think that Paul Burdick is a relatively good judge, and I'm very glad that he is the person overseeing the case. And it may be interesting today to see what happens. It will be interesting today to see what happens. And I'm interested to see if he will follow up on his statement that he was going to have some sanctions against the district attorney and their lack of forthrightness in sharing evidence with the defense attorneys.
You're being very diplomatic. Rebecca Young violated his explicit orders that all discovery be available, and had no real excuse. Hey, Desiree. I was discouraged that they didn't drop these charges based upon prosecutorial failure to provide discovery. It seemed to me he was trying to protect the district attorney's office after what was really a clear record of repeated failure to provide discovery. And he, of course, I think, is concerned that, you know, somebody created vandalism, and there was dispute about how much vandalism inside this bank. Though, as far as I know, none of the people who are charged did anything of the kind, and I've spoken to them personally and so forth. That's my feeling. But
You know, Burdick seems to want to have it. He thinks somebody did it, and he wants to have due respect, I guess, to the district attorney's office. I would call it undue respect, actually, because, you know, she had from February to August. They actually had from December to August to pursue these charges in a realistic way, where they found real people who actually did real vandalism, and they haven't done that. Instead, they've, you know, produced all kinds of problems for many, many people here. Not just the 11 charge, but people who have to support them, people who could be doing better things. And I think this is really a politically motivated activity that may be concerned more with eliminating a kind of political opposition of a more active direct action sort. What's your feeling about that?
Well, I was just going to say, with some of what you were just saying just now, is that I think it's actually, this whole process is, although it is, it's certainly a labyrinth of legal minutia and structure and all of that. At the same time, it's incredibly revealing. Every step of this whole process, certainly for me and my process, it was very revealing every step of the way, what was done, what wasn't done, how things were framed, all of that. And I think that will be certainly very very much a part of, for me, what I might glean from today and on Monday as well.
But you don't have a direct sense of whether this is designed to repress, let's say, the Occupy movement or similar movements that are engaging in direct action, and maybe taking over vacant buildings that aren't being used while people are freezing outside.
I think it's very, it's very interesting to see the national trends, and I think that is very connected to this. This is very connected to the national trends, and the national trends of excessive punishment for minor, if even existing, offenses, whether it's a, you know, somebody being charged with felonies and facing 8 years in prison for a what should be actually a misdemeanor. And that's happened in Oakland, it's happened in New York, it's happened in many different parts of the United States, focused specifically on the Occupy movement. And it very much, I think, also relates to the whole history of COINTELPRO, the FBI, and, you know, serious
grand jury investigations of animal rights activists.
Mm-hmm. That too. But I think also really violations of the Constitution and people's basic civil rights by a branch of the U.S. government. And I think that should be really, you know, we all need to...
But it couldn't happen in Santa Cruz.
Why not?
Maybe it is happening in Santa Cruz.
Yeah.
We've been talking with
Grant.
Thank you, Grant.
Thanks, Robert.
$1,000 limit. Why does it go to out-of-town attorneys when the people who are really affected were the defendants we had, myself included?
This is Becky Johnson in the hallway after Judge Paul Burdick, in essence. And I'm not sure if this was on the same day as the previous interview with Grant Wilson or 3 days later when there was a hearing. The preliminary hearing, there was actually a two-day preliminary hearing where Rebecca Young was sanctioned to the extent of $500. This is Becky Johnson, essentially commenting on the fact that, the attorneys themselves expressed, two attorneys, Alexis Briggs and David Beauvais, attorneys for Cameron Laurendeau and me, respectively, that they had to spend $5,000 to $7,000 that they wouldn't have had to spend coming down here, paying for accommodations, their time on essentially fruitless trips to the court because Rebecca Young either failed or intentionally refused to provide the evidence that they needed to resolve this case in court. And instead of the $10,000 to $14,000, the judge said, oh, we're only going to do $500 because we don't want the case to go above $1,000, because that would mean it would go to the Bar Association, which might reflect badly on Rebecca Young. Yeah, I would wonder, too. I'm imagining people hear that and they think, well, why would you be protecting someone when the consequence of their actions is to cost other people time and money that they shouldn't have to spend, and that the person who's creating that problem should be responsible for. And the answer is, we protect our own. The court protects the district attorney's office. But even more important, and what Becky was talking about, is that nowhere in this discussion, either from the attorneys or from the judge or from the district attorney or from the media, well, I talk about it, is there a discussion of the impact on the defendants who have had to trek in again and again to the court under threat of being arrested and dragged into jail if they don't get there for these fruitless hearings, one after another after another. Some of whom don't have the money to even get there. Some of whom are living in their vehicles. One of whom has attempted suicide. Others have lost their jobs. These are real consequences to a malicious prosecution that aren't even being discussed in terms of sanctions, even when it's clear and acknowledged by the court that the district attorney's office is in default, that it is in guilty of a form of negligence, if not malfeasance, by violating court orders to provide discovery, which she has refused or declined or failed to do. Defendants aren't even being thought about here. It's all about, you know, the privileges, priorities, and prerogatives of the attorneys. Of course, that's no surprise, but it's outrageous, obviously. Completely outrageous.
You know, I've gone almost 11 months from when I was arrested to where I even get a preliminary hearing. 20 court appearances.
I don't see the harm in us calculating our time, but the problem is, I mean, we can ask for it, but the problem is it comes out of the same coffer, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
So they get it from the district attorney. I guess it would be nice to put it into the alternate attorney fund. But
this is one of the attorneys giving you her... I was going to say her rationalization, but, you know, it's her perspective on it.
After that statement, I'm not convinced we're going to get more than $1,000 anyway.
Yeah, that's
certainly worth trying.
To protect the reputation of the assistant district attorney.
I certainly
think it's worth trying.
Over $1,000 in income as a substitute teacher since last February, since I cannot work as a substitute with
Who's
these...
Who's your attorney?
Dan Klima.
Okay. Because it might be worth, you know, talking about that as well. You know, you lost income having to come to these appearances.
Yeah.
And we've been listening to
Lisa McCaney.
Thanks, Lisa.
And Lisa McCaney is the attorney for Brent Adams. And of course, nobody did talk about that at the hearing. I don't think. Maybe I could be wrong. But it didn't get any serious consideration. And of course, it's really the key issue here is how defendants are treated, not how attorneys are treated. But of course, as privilege rears its ugly head and becomes fossilized and encapsulated and petrified as a kind of an overweening structure over all of us, they, of course, become the key people. Their interests become more important than the interests of the people that they were appointed or paid or elected to serve.
Your attorney for...
Brett Adams.
Thanks. So, Dan, did you get what you were looking for in terms of the sanctions? Or that sound like the judge has said only $1,000 maximum for... and you're coming down from San Francisco now, right?
No, it was... Judge Burdick seemed to drop off significantly from where we were a couple months ago when he was discussing dismissing the case entirely.
This is Dan Klima, who is the attorney, or was the attorney for Becky Johnson before her case was dismissed for inadequate evidence after... months and months and months of hearings and rehearings and coming in to look for discovery that Rebecca Young failed and failed and failed to provide against charges that were bogus in the first place.
I was saying this isn't a big, you know, this is important enough to order sanctions over $1,000. That was disappointing.
That's total, I guess, for all attorneys.
What have your expenses been? Would you estimate?
I don't have to look at the hours. I don't know. It's huge. I mean, it in comparison to what he's.
This is David Beauvais, who was my attorney, who estimated expenses at, I think, $5,000 to $7,000 at one point.
Willing to give, it's huge. So.
And you are?
David Beauvais.
Attorney of law.
Yes.
And nobody was saying.
Right? We're listening to Steve Plates in the hallway.
They're loath to do that.
Get the bar just makes a claim. Like Wells Fargo made a claim for
something. And a member of the public asked, what about the Wells Fargo claim? And Steve.
It just. Yeah. What?
I don't know. No, I'm just listening in on your thoughts, Steve Plates. A question arose, we don't want to say from who, but what was the question and what was the answer?
Oh, Sylvia was wondering whether or not it would be worthwhile to file some kind of formal complaint against Rebecca Young, even if Judge Burdick doesn't issue sanctions or he doesn't issue sanctions above the $1,000 reporting level. to the state bar, and so that was the whole discussion. And my feeling is that most attorneys are like police officers. They are loath to have complaints, you know, filed against other lawyers, regardless of how incompetent they are, because they're all part of a collegial
conspiracy against the public.
Well, it's like the, what is it, the blue sheet of blue, what do they call it?
Blue code of silence.
Whatever it is. So, you know, although they would be like, they would like to get a couple of bucks and they'd like to have the sanctions imposed, I don't think they want to rise to the level of a state bar complaint, because they're all protective of one another. And that's why Judge Burdick, who is a lawyer himself, is loath to impose sanctions over the $1,000, because that would automatically trigger a report to the state bar, and they don't want to do that.
Can we ourselves complain to the state bar?
Sure, anybody can do that. But whether or not they would investigate, and whether or not they would find that the court has made a determination, and so they're not going to investigate any further, is probably what they would do. They would say, yes, we're looking into this. Yes, we've seen that the court has imposed sanctions in the amount of blah, blah, blah. That's not the over-the-reportable limit for us, so we would say thank you for your interest, and that's all as far as it's going to go. So you wouldn't have, you know, you would have the report of a complaint, but not a complaint that was investigated.
Would a complaint by an attorney be more effective than a complaint by a mere mortal?
Well, yeah, I suppose so, but I don't know any attorney would do it.
Well, my attorney might be persuaded.
Well, you better talk to your attorney about that. I doubt very seriously that he's going to make many complaints against other attorneys unless it's extremely egregious.
Yes. We'll see if he agrees with your pontificating on this thing.
There you go. Absolutely. Well, you should.
Look at the show. You've got to make people wear them.
Angel, do you have any incriminating statements you'd like to make at this time?
Yeah, I feel that incriminating on the part of the system, absolutely. I feel that even though that there's still no evidence produced, which I knew that there's not, because I simply didn't do those things that they've accused me of.
Felony vandalize? You weren't conspiring to vandalize?
No,
you didn't trespass?
Absolutely.
And there was no conspiracy to trespass?
Absolutely not. Actually, when the police showed up and they...
We don't need you to give details at this time, unless you feel like it, of course.
No.
Well, when they, you know, when they showed up and they asked everybody to leave, everybody obeyed the law and left.
We'll see if the video bears that out, Mr. Alcantara. And do you have any other statements you wish to make that might help us to convict you? Well,
and it's interesting. It's really hard to speak in a common sense way about what happened at 75 River Street. But in fact, what did happen was the building was cleared peacefully, and everyone left. And the fact that there was some vandalism there, you know, I was going to say, for me to say it was regrettable, in a sense, sure, it was regrettable, because it reflected badly on the some of the idealists, I think, who were involved in this, trying to create a community center. In another sense, from the point of view of those who are angry at Wells Fargo, it pales in significance next to the kind of fundamentally destructive behavior of Wells Fargo, and in essence is a form of outrage against what they did, although some might regard it as a form of adolescent capriciousness and self-indulgence, considering the impact on a conservative segment of the community, which rules in Santa Cruz and provides them with a pretext for repressing the broader movement. That's certainly true, but you also have to consider, I think, that, as I said, when Angel says nothing, you know, everyone left when they were, the building was ultimately cleared with the assistance, actually, of some of the people who are being charged, in the sense that they served as liaisons and intermediaries, and that's what's, you know, even more outrageous. The people who are helpful are being punished for their kindness, are being punished for their willingness to cooperate and not to cover their faces and not to hide their identities. It is grossly, blatantly a form of, it shows you how the district attorney's office and the police department just don't give a shit about the human values here involved, about the constitutional rights of the people involved, and about, you know, the dynamic of what actually happened. It's like a machine that has been, you know, chugged into a starting position and just doesn't stop, and it gets fed with taxpayer dollars and fed with the kind of inherited prestige that police and prosecutorial agencies have, and then just moves along like a juggernaut. unstoppable because it has to maintain its own reputation. It can't be wrong, you see.
Thank you. How about you, madam? She shakes her head.
Just some thoughts, sort of vague. We're here at the Santa Cruz Diner after the hearing, where you've heard a few notes on it. But I'm talking with someone who came to the hearing in support, Joy Hens, who has been doing work on foreclosure. Joy, I know you're not really ready to be, you know, ambushed as usual in a tape recording. But you've been working on it. What's happened in the last few weeks, and what's the significance of the new state foreclosure law settlement, whatever, that's coming to power?
The Homeowners Bill of Rights went into effect January 1st, and there's actually a fair amount of optimism that people have because gives a lot of rights to homeowners that they haven't had over the past 3 years, including the right to sue their lenders, which, of course, they have to have the money or be able to somehow get a contingent fee from an attorney to do, but they have that right to sue them for a fraud closure, and they cannot be dual-tracked anymore, which means they can't be foreclosed on while the lender says they're considering them for a loan modification. The lenders have to give certain notifications, multiple notifications. They have to have one point of contact. So we're, you know, cautiously optimistic about some of that. The only problem is that we've also heard that lenders are moving their servicing overseas so that they can get around these requirements. And so we're not...
less loans here, right?
No, it's the servicing, just the servicing.
Servicing. What does the servicing involve? I'm sorry. We'll get back to Joy in a minute.
You know, it's interesting to me that, so now individuals can sue the big banks... good luck against their lawyers, but it doesn't sound like it's a criminal in any way that will hold the bank employees accountable if they actually try this shady tactic, this vicious tactic of telling people, we're not going to consider modifying your loan unless you stop paying for your mortgage and then go into default, which then puts people into a position where they don't know where their loan is, and suddenly they learn, well, we're not going to modify your loan, and we're defaulting on you because you didn't pay because we told you not to. I know, it sounds like a real catch-22, and it is, but it has been the case in thousands of loans by Wells Fargo and other banks. It's a form of a dual tracking, which is now supposedly, I don't know if it's been made illegal or improper. I don't know if it will be the basis for DA Bob Lee to get off his ass and actually go after Wells Fargo and other institutions, and to see if they are, in fact, following these guidelines. We haven't had the auditor do what the San Francisco auditor did, is determine how many shady procedures are actually have been engaged in by the local banks and credit unions. I'm not sure that they're so innocent either. We have to be sweeping in what we see, how we investigate, what we examine, far-reaching and fair in that kind of analysis. And if I knew anything about it, I could talk about it more intelligently. We're running out of time here, up against the clock. Uncle Dennis is due in at any moment. And I want to remind people that tomorrow Brent Adams goes into this infraction trial, essentially for trying to monitor police behavior as with the Get Rid of the Homeless downtown ordinance crackdown that the police have been charged with and have been doing even when they aren't charged with it, sometimes just because they apparently feel like it. If the police were only doing this on complaint, I would still find it egregious. But the fact that they don't do it on complaint, and they do it just when they see it because they feel like it, somebody sitting next to a building, and then they go after the person who's documenting it on a video, as Brent Adams may have been doing, or at least observing it. Again, I'm not sure if he was actually videoing at the time, but he is a video journalist, so it's quite possible he was. That's even more egregious. So let's show up tomorrow, and that includes Uncle Dennis here. Hopefully he'll show up at 10 o'clock tomorrow at the Brent Adams trial to see that, in fact, it's going to be Judge Gallagher or perhaps Judge Connolly, unless the judges have shifted around again. And they're pretty shifty, I can tell you, to see that justice is done. But as they say, in the halls of justice, the only justice is in the halls. So, I want to thank you for listening to this edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides. If I'm not here on Sunday, check for me next week at 6 o'clock. Uncle Dennis has got some cool shit coming up, don't you, Uncle Dennis?
Yeah, new stuff.
Now, what kind of new stuff is that?
We got some new CDs.
Ah, yes. And, of course, some of your own. I see have you bought a bottle of wine with you, as usual?
Well, that would be...
Oh, no.
Beer.
Oh, beer, wine, all these things look alike to me. You have a number of CDs, which these are from the 60s and 70s, I understand.
And beyond.
And beyond.
This is from the 60s and 70s.
There's a picture of a cow here. What is this supposed to mean? Pink Floyd.
Classic Pink Floyd album, Adam Hart Mother.
Oh, okay. Isn't that Cowabunga from the Howdy Doody show or anything like
something
that?
Something like that.
Yeah, okay. Well, I want to thank everybody for bearing with me, and I'm going to barrel on out of here.
Bear without you.
And I'll just bear it outside, and maybe even I'll grin
if
as I do.
Downtown, you'll get arrested.
I want to let you know that I'm going to check out a police video up in Oakland done by our very own James Smash That Columbus Statue Costner, who has put together a video of statewide police misconduct, known more fondly as Jim Costner. I'll give you a report on that when I get back. And yes, that's about it. Do any reporting about what's going on the streets, you want to get in touch with me, do contact me at the Huff Line, 423-HUFF, 423-4833. I will get back to you when I can, and I will be back on the air maybe Sunday morning at 9:30, and certainly on Thursday at 6, and Uncle Dennis, carry on as best you can.
educated boy.
Oh,
And you're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.3 FM. I'm Uncle Dennis. We've managed to get Robert out of the studio and on his way to wherever he's going. Probably home. But he might meet with someone before then.